So let's go on. Stop it in the four. So against them or show favoritism against them. But then this verse shows me that it's even a step further. It's almost as if it's people that they know that are part of their congregation, people that are already Christians that they're almost turning their back on and discriminating. It's like you're a Christian, but you know, you don't have everything. You don't look good. So just stay there. You're okay there. Just stand up in the back. And we'll go over here, and these people here, we're gonna hang with them. But you can come in, and you can worship with us. But you know, you need to stand up there, or don't come to my house. Just stay here. And it's heartbreaking to me to think of them as discriminating against their fellow Christians. But then it's even worse to think that even when we don't realize it, we probably have done it ourselves. And we may be doing it today. We may have done it this week. We're probably going to do it again. And it's something we should avoid because it's just not right. It's sinful. You know, it tells us that we need to reach out to those who are in distress. We need to meet each other's needs. And then the next verse is even take it a little further. It says, "But you have dishonored the poor man. Is it not the rich who oppress you and personally drag you into court? Do they not blaspheme the fair name by which you have been called?" So then it's not even just that they're discriminating against the poor and going close to the ones that have everything together necessarily that are rich or clean cut necessarily that are even Christians. It says in 7, "Do they not blaspheme the fair name by which you have been called?" And 6, "Is it not the rich who oppress you and personally drag you into court?" And so the picture I get of what the church was doing here was that they were being economically and physically and in all ways you can think of persecuted. I could imagine the place where Christianity is outlawed, that just to do business with a Christian was probably an offense enough to have people, you know, think you're a Christian and put you in with them. And so people that were simply afraid and weren't Christians probably didn't want to do business with them or anything. And so what kind of picture I get here is that it's like they're currying favor with the bully. It's like the fourth grader that it gets their lunch money stolen every day by a medium-sized bully, right? The kid that's not, you know, picks on the really small kid and gets picked on by somebody else. And so to circumvent that, he goes to the big boy and becomes friends with the big boy. So he's not picked on by the little bully, right? And so he avoids a little bit, you know, he probably gets picked on by the big bully, right? I did this a little bit in high school. My brother's best friend was a senior and I was a freshman and he was a bully. And he picked on me all the time, beat me up, threw my backpack in a tree. One time I actually got knocked unconscious and he had to drag me to class and leave me in a heap in a chair. Yeah. And but I was picked on in junior high. Anytime anyone else, he would never, aside from knocking me out, he never picked on me again after that because he never wanted to seriously hurt me. But people that would have seriously hurt me, anytime someone came around, he beat up a lot of people for me. Yes, including me. And so that's kind of here. But, and you know, that's kind of funny and everything, right? But for me, that guy was a guy that went to church and claimed to be a Christian at the time. But the bully that these guys were currying favor to was the one that was going to have other Christians taken out and stoned. Was the one that was going to talk about how Christianity was wrong and evil. And that, you know, depending on where they were, that, you know, the emperor was God. They were currying up. They were currying favor with someone that was blaspheming God. And they were becoming, what I see here is that they were becoming friends with the world and borderline enemies with God. Right? It says, we'll talk about this later on, but in 4:4, it says, "You adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is hostility toward God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. What they were doing was they were going and they were drawing close to the world, not knowing that by drawing close to the world, they were losing, you know, they're drawing away from the things of heaven. They're trying to draw towards the things of the earth, money, wealth, popularity, status, life. And they were beginning almost to love it more than they were to love the things of God. And James is just starting to warn them here, and he'll get to it in 4, that is, the things of this earth are going to perish. And if you draw close to those things, and you choose them over the things of heaven, you'll perish too. Because you can't have the things of the earth you can't have the things of the earth and God. You can't be a friend of the devil and God. Starting verse 8, if, however, you are fulfilling the royal law according to the scripture, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, you are doing well. But if you show partiality, you are committing sin and are convicted by the law as transgressors. For whoever keeps the whole law and yet stumbles in one point, he has become guilty of all. For he who said, do not commit adultery, also said, do not commit murder. Now, if you do not commit adultery, but do commit murder, you've become a transgressor of the law. This is another point where he's writing to the non-Christian Jewish people who feel that they can become righteous through the law. Think that the law is good enough, right? Think that if they follow the law, they can become good enough. And he comes and he shows them a third strike. And he says, pretty much, if you fall guilty at one place, you're just as guilty as if you broke them all, right? I taught this passage in Sunday school, and I was thinking about it, and I had this thought that came into my head in the middle of Sunday school. It's not a salad bar, right? It's not a place where you can walk up and you can go, okay, I don't like salad. I don't like red onions, but I like croutons, I like cheese, I like ham, I like bacon bits, and I like ranch dressing. No tomatoes. No tomatoes. No tomatoes. Okay, I'm sorry. And I do eat salad. I do eat actual salad some. Very little, but I do eat some. But that's what I would have done when I was younger, right? And so the salad bar, you could pick and choose what you want. You can eat what you want. You can leave what you don't. But what he's telling them is that the law is not like that. God's law is not a pick and choose, take what you want, leave what you don't kind of thing. You take it all, and if you want to try the law, you have to keep every single piece. You know, not just the Ten Commandments, but the whole book of the law. Every law, you have to keep it all, and you can't. If you fail at one place, you're going to fail. And he's already pointed out twice where they thought they hadn't failed and they had. He's already pointed that out twice. So he's going again. He's saying once again, it's just not going to work, guys. Come on. I tried it. Paul tried it. It's just not going to work. Start picking up at 12. It says, so speak and so act as those who are to be judged by the law of liberty. For judgment will be merciless to one who has shown mercy. Mercy triumphs over judgment. I like the last part of that last verse. It says, for judgment will be merciless to one who has shown no mercy. And mercy triumphs over judgment. Which is cool, because, you know, we talk about other places that when you read that all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, right? And that the wages of sin is death. And so we've all sinned, but then God gives us mercy, sends his son to die on the cross, and then we can be saved that we can go to heaven, right? So we don't get that. That's cool. Anyway, we're gonna move on to the last half. It transitions from abruptly here. It goes from talking about what it has and judgment and showing favoritism to discussion of faith and works. In 17 it says, even so faith, if it has no... Oh, I skipped. Sorry, go back to 14, not 17. I skipped further down. 14 says, what use is it, my brethren, if someone says he has faith, but he has no works? Can that faith save him? If a brother or sister is without clothing and in need of daily food, and one of you says to them, go in peace, be warm and be filled, and yet you do not give them what is necessary for their body. Sorry, excuse me. What use is that? Even so, by faith, if it has no works, is dead, being by itself. So this first part is just so true, right? What if I was walking down the road in like Alaska, and like I had a bunch of coats, two or three coats on, and I was hot and sweating, and I saw someone here in the crowd that I knew, and they're walking around in a t-shirt and shorts and flip flops, and it was like negative 20 degrees, and I looked up to them and said, "Get a coat, you'll be warm. Coats are warm." And then said, "I have an extra coat," and then walked away and didn't give them my extra coat. I mean, you know. It just isn't going to work. You have to actually give them the coat to give them warmth. I can't say, go, be warm, be happy, be safe. You know, and it just happened, right? And, you know, that's what I think of when I think of these examples. It's just, it would just be crazy. And another thing I've heard someone say in the past was, you know, just like you can't go into your driveway and see, you know, your car, which is adequate. You know, you like it. It may not be new, but it gets you from point A to point B. And you can't put your hand on it and just look at it and rub your hand along it and say it's a Ferrari, right? And say it's a Ferrari and say it's a Ferrari. And then it won't be a Ferrari. It's just like I've also heard someone else say, you can't sit in a church and go to church and not do anything and say you're Christian, every week. Every week, and not do anything about it, not ever accept Christ, not ever let it change you, not ever let it do anything, and even though you said you're a Christian, become a Christian, right? And that's kind of where James is going with this faith. Even so, faith if it has no works is dead, being by itself. He's talking about how if you say you have faith, your works are going to show that you have faith. You know, the proof is going to be in the way your life is affected. 2 weeks ago, we talked about the beginning of James. We talked about perseverance and the testing of your faith, developing perseverance. And in talking about that, we talked about how the people that have persevered gain the crown of life, right? And we talked about how those that don't persevere don't lose their salvation. They never had faith. They never had salvation. And so you can see how their lack of faith was brought out, or was not brought out, but shown by their actions, right? Because we know that they didn't have faith because they went out from us and they're no longer of us, or they're no longer with us. And they never had faith. So in the same way, the opposite is true in that your actions are going to show that you have faith. And so if you claim to have faith and you say you have faith, but every time something comes up in your life, we talked about when you talk about perseverance, it's that when problems come, when you're tested, when something happens and your faith is tested, perseverance is developed because you hold steadfast to Christ and you don't let go, you don't abandon Christ. But if every time a kind of a trial comes, you throw your hands up and you give up and you kind of turn your back on God and everything, and you know, and you don't hold faith, hold fast to Christ. But then you continue to say you're a Christian, you know, it's your actions are going to show your faith, is what he's talking about. And then he goes on, he says, but someone may well say, you have faith and I have works. Show me your faith without my works, and I will show you my faith by my works. You believe that God is one. You do well. The demons also believe and shudder. I like that verse because I've heard people say that believing in God is enough, right? I've heard people say that just believing is enough. Just believing that he's there is enough. That's all I'm going to do. I'm just going to believe that he's there. And yet, here in James, it straight up says, you believe that God is one. You do well. So do the demons. And they believe and shudder. Spiritually says, oh yeah, you believe in God? That's nice. That's okay. That's good. I'm glad you do. But so does the devil. Yeah, because it's not enough to just believe in God. Because you can believe in God and yet refuse to accept Christ, refuse to accept the fact that you can't go to heaven, that you can't make yourself good enough, right? You can refuse to accept the fact that there's nothing you can do to gain salvation. You can refuse to accept the fact that Christ is the Son of God. And if you do that, you're not a Christian. I mean, it says that in 1 John pretty much. I mean, I don't remember the exact word. But anyway, and so it's, I like this because it just straight up shows you what the expectation level is. It's not that you believe in God. It's further than that. There are other expectations, right? There's more than that. But are you willing, starting in verse 20, but are you willing to recognize, you foolish fellow, that faith without works is useless? Was not Abraham our father justified by works when he offered up Isaac his son on the altar? You see that faith was working with his works, and as a result of the works, faith was perfected. And the scripture was fulfilled which says, and Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness, and he was called a friend of God. You see that a man is justified by works and not by faith alone. In the same way, was not Rahab the harlot also justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out by another way? For just as the body without the spirit is dead, also faith without works is dead. So he goes on and he gives two Old Testament examples of how someone's actions or their works showed their faith, right? And the first one that he gives is of Abraham, and it's in Genesis 22. Oh, try my bookmark. Thank you. And it's the story of Abraham when God asked him to sacrifice his son Isaac. I'm going to read a lot of Genesis 22 real quick. Sorry, I forgot to give you that one, Logan. Sorry. I just realized that. He asked me what scripture he had, and I just told him James. Sorry. In Genesis 22, it says, starting in verse 1, it says, now it came about after these things that God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham. And he said, here I am. And he said, take now your son, your only son whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I will tell you. So Abraham rose early in the morning and saddled his donkey and took two of his young men with him and Isaac his son, and he split wood for the burnt offering and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. On the third day, Abraham raised his eyes and saw the place from a distance. Abraham said to his young men, stay here with the donkey, and I and the lad will go over there, and we will worship and return to you. Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac his son, and he took in his hand the fire and the knife. So the two of them walked on together. Isaac spoke to Abraham his father and said, my father. And he said, here I am, my son. And he said, behold, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering? And Abraham said, God will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. So the two of them walked on together. Then they came to the place of which God had told him, and Abraham built the altar there and arranged the wood, bound his son Isaac, and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called out to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, Here I am. He said, Do not stretch out your hand against the lad and do nothing to him, for now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. Then Abraham raised his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him a ram caught in the thicket by his horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered him up for a burnt offering in the place of his son. Abraham called the name of the place, The Lord will provide. As it is said to this day, in the mount of the Lord it will be provided. A little bit of background here, because if you know the story leading up to this, it makes the faith of Abraham even more impressive, right? So God came to Abraham earlier in Genesis and told him to pick up his family and move, and he did, and it goes on, and God goes to Abraham and says, I will make your descendants a mighty nation that can't be counted. And Abraham didn't have a son. And then God said, I'll give you a child. What I haven't told you is that they were really, Abraham and his wife were really old at this point. They were in their 90s, and they didn't believe that God would give them a child, because, as they said, they're well past childbearing age. And yet, God did give them a son. He gave them a son, Isaac, in their old age, which is pretty amazing. And so God has promised Abraham that his descendants will be a mighty nation through his son Isaac, who he gave to him in his old age. And Abraham has faith that God's going to make his descendants a mighty nation. And then God tells him, take your only son, the one I gave you through a miracle in your very old age, and take him on the mountain and sacrifice him. And that is a tough thing to ask of anybody for their child. To sacrifice their child. That is something that would be hugely difficult for someone to do and to have asked of them, and then to add on the fact that it's their only child and most likely could be their only child because of their age. And yet Abraham goes up. He goes to the mountain in faith. He tells his son that God will provide, because he has faith that God is going to make his descendants a mighty nation. And then God provides. If Abraham had gone there with his son Isaac, and God asks him, hey, take your son up to this mountain and sacrifice him, and Abraham had gone up and said no and freaked out, his actions would have shown his lack of faith here, right? And in the same way, his actions show his faith, right? And I just want everybody to think about how it's our actions that are going to show the level of faith that we actually have. Our actions every day and everywhere we go are what show our faith level. You know, it's kind of the idea, and a little more important than the idea, that actions speak louder than words, right? You can say what you want, but what really shows what faith you have is how you react when things come up, how you react when God asks you to do something, how you react when problems come, when something happens, you know, economically, you lose your job, this happens, that, there's all kinds of things that are going to happen. And the way you react, the way you respond, are what show what level of faith you had. Now, the other example that he mentions here is the example of Rahab, and that's in Joshua. And I'm not going to go and read totally through it. It actually is. You want me to? Okay. No, listen. I can't. Joshua starts at 2. Chapter 2. 2 starts in 2:1. And the book of Joshua, he's leading. Joshua is told, I got to lead the people into the promised land. And the first place that they come to is Jericho. And in chapter 2, God, we'll just read it. It says, is it up there? Okay. Then Joshua, the son of Nun, sent two men as spies secretly from, I don't know how to pronounce that, saying, go view the land, especially Jericho. So they went and came to the house of a harlot whose name was Rahab and lodged there. It was told the king of Jericho, saying, behold, men from the sons of Israel have come here tonight to search out the land. And the king of Jericho sent word to Rahab, saying, bring out the men who have come to you, who have entered your house, for they have come to search out all the land. But the woman had taken the two men and hidden them, and she said, yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they were from. It came about when it was time to shut the gate at dark, and the men went out. I do not know where the men went. Pursue them quickly, for you will overtake them. But she had brought them up to the roof and hidden them in stacks and stalks of flax, which she had laid in order on the roof. Sorry. So the men pursued them on the road to Jordan to the fords, and as soon as those who were pursuing them had gone out, they shut the gate. Now before they lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to the men, I know that the Lord has given you the land, and that the terror of you has fallen on us, and that all the inhabitants of the land have melted away before you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. When we heard it, our hearts melted, and no courage remained in any man longer because of you. For the Lord your God, he has God in heaven above and on earth. Now therefore, please swear to me by the Lord, since I have dealt kindly with you, that you also will deal kindly with my father's household, and give me a pledge of truth, and spare my father and my mother and my brothers and my sisters with all who belong to them, and deliver our lives from death. So what happened when the Israelites left Egypt and through all their travels went on before them into the promised land, into the city of Jericho, and it terrified them, right? It frightened them. And one of the people that heard it was Rahab. And it says that she knew, that she had faith that God would give the Israelites the city of Jericho and anything they wanted, and that there's nothing that would stop that. And so she responded by helping them and not hindering them, because she feared the Lord, and she knew that there's nothing she could do to stand in the way, so she took his side instead. And so then like Abraham, what showed her faith and fear of the Lord was her actions, because she could have responded like the king and stood in the way of the Lord and tried to stop him. Like I said before, refused, been like people that refuse the knowledge of the, refuse to believe the truth that they can do nothing to make them to get to heaven. She could have refused to believe that there was nothing she could do to fight against God. Instead, she went on his side. And so I just want to leave you guys with this evening with the question of how do you respond, and what do you do? What do your actions say about you? when things come up and you have choices to make, do you live by faith? Dear Lord, I just want to thank you this evening for letting us come together and just to read your scriptures and worship you, Lord. And just God, just help us this week. Just remember that in everything we do, we should do it for you, Lord, just to live for you. We love you. We praise your name. Amen.